All right, are we back on the air, Jerry? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Can everyone out there in the chat room hear us now? If somebody can say something to us either way.
Yeah, please.
Any second.
If you could, yeah, all right. Eric doesn't hear anything.
That was already typed in there.
Okay.
We had some technical difficulties at the top of the show. And we're waiting to hear if somebody on the line can hear us. Okay, this is Movie Geeks United. If anyone's out there, okay. All right, success. Great success.
All right, awesome. All right, thank God.
Who knows what the opening of that show sounded like. We were 5 seconds away from showtime, and it disconnected us.
Yes, it did.
It's not April 1st yet, is it? I mean, we're still weeks away.
Yeah, I know.
Hey, let's give the intro down. You might as well. You're right. Tonight, Michael Ian Black, one of our favorite comedic minds, joins us to discuss his new film, Run, Fat Boy, Run. Plus, director Harry Basil and the screenwriting Cleveland Brothers tell us about their latest effort, Fingerprints. Then, director Chris Severtson and actor Mark Center stop by to discuss their terrifying new horror film, The Lost. It is all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Hey, welcome to a very special midweek episode of Movie Geeks United. I am your co-host. My name is Jamie, and Jerry is here too. Hey, guy.
Hey, how you doing? I can't tell you how happy I was to hear the theme music. I've never been that happy in a long time to hear it.
Very happy to hear that crappy theme music. Man, we need to get something new. I can't find anything.
We're going to have to talk to people and see if we can use, like, some famous piece of music or something.
Yeah. What do you think, like the 2001 theme or something?
Something like that. In honor of Arthur C. Clarke, yes, definitely.
Right. And then he just passed yesterday.
Yeah. It was a big, start out with the really sudden news of Anthony Minghella's death, and then last night, Arthur C. Clarke, I mean, talk about losing two giants. I mean...
Yeah, and then, you know, obviously Arthur C. Clarke was... What, 90, 91?
He was 90 years old, so it's not... But still, I mean, like, you notice lately when we're hit with these things, it's like two in, like, one day, and it's just like...
Yeah, and you get a sense of the enormity of his achievement, you know, which is vast.
Yeah.
And the Minghella, I mean, taken from us much too soon.
Way too soon.
54 years old, made some dynamite movies, English Patient, Cold Mountain.
And The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Oh, Talented Mr. Ripley.
I love that's my favorite probably of all of them. That's probably.
I think so too. I think it's the most challenging, and yeah, I think it's a great film. So we lost him much too soon. We're waiting for our first guest, and our first guest is Michael Ian Black to call in. We're hoping the same thing that happened last show doesn't happen this one, because we've really sent the reminder message after reminder message. So hopefully we'll hear from him in a couple of minutes. In the meantime, let me tell you about some upcoming shows. We got some great ones, Jerry.
We have a lot of awesome things coming up.
Yes, we do. This Sunday, we're going to welcome Mark Harris to the show. And who is Mark Harris?
He is, well, first of all, I think some of our listeners may know him as he writes a column for Entertainment Weekly on the back page. And also, he wrote this new book, Pictures at the Revolution.
Yes,
and a very interesting book.
And what does that book cover, Jerry?
It covers the best picture race, and you're going to help me out with the year here. 68?
Well, I think the actual award ceremony took place in 68 for the pictures.
It was in 67, but of the groundbreaking, let's talk about the groundbreaking films of Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, and not so groundbreaking, Dr. Doolittle, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and, of course, groundbreaking In the Heat of the Night.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting, because I got to tell you, folks, these kind of books, you learn these little tidbits of information and that you didn't know. I mean, both Jamie, Chris, and I have read on this a lot of the recent, you could say from 65 on, we know a lot about. But you always find new information out.
Yeah, yeah, it's quite a book, and it's been getting a lot of press. It's one of those high-profile books. And
we got them. So
we're very anxious to speak to him Sunday. And then Wednesday, we have our special two-hour Paul Schrader tribute. And so far, we have confirmed Jeff Goldblum and Dana Delaney to take part in that. Paul Schrader, if you're not aware, if you're under a rock someplace, he is the writer of classic films like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Bringing Out the Dead, which I made a observation about Taxi Driver and Bringing Out the Dead the other night, and I'm looking forward to bringing it up to Mr. Schrader.
Okay, cool.
Because really, Bringing Out the Dead seems like Taxi Driver plus 30 years in between, plus that maturity in the path of the lead character and the way the story's told.
True.
Yeah, it really does. He also directed movies like Affliction and American Gigolo and on and on and on. Autofocus.
And speaking of that, Criterion in June is going to release a special edition of Mishima on DVD.
A Life in Four Chapters, which is another one of his films, I think, from 85.
Folks, you can buy that for me if you really have a kind, soft place in your heart. You can buy that for me.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We're looking forward to that. And the good thing about Goldblum is we did a pre-recorded conversation with Goldblum, so we know he's going to show up.
Yeah, exactly. That is something we don't have to worry about. But he's like your best friend. He really, you know, from what you played the other night, you guys really got along.
The Bloomer and I connected. I felt a certain camaraderie there, then again, I think he can meet a complete stranger on the street and make them feel like, you know.
Oh, I think so.
That's the
charm of the characters he plays, too.
Yeah, he has a special way about him. I took a cold shower after the interview. It was amazing.
Okay, did not need to know that. I really, you know, thanks. I might
hang Sunday, we're welcoming on Paul Schrader himself, and he will come on. He'll discuss his brilliant body of work. And after him, we welcome Ira Sachs, the director of the new film Married Life with Pierce Brosnan and Chris Cooper, Rachel McAdams, and Patricia Clarkson.
That's quite a cast
of the year, man.
Yeah.
And so we're waiting for our first guest to call in. His call has not registered yet on our call-in line. So I know we had some difficulty earlier in the evening. So if he's trying to connect, hopefully he'll try a few more times because his number hasn't shown up yet for us to patch him in. So what's been going on since Sunday, Jerry?
Well, you know what? Oh, why don't we just go get this out in the open? You know what I watched last night?
I watched,
after our whole discussion about Funny Games, I've, of course, put every Michael Haneke film I haven't seen in my Netflix queue. So I watched Benny's video last night. And I don't know if you're familiar with that film or not.
No, what is it?
Benny's video. You could say it's like the first part of a trilogy, if you include that, the original Funny Games and Caché. You could say
that. Oh, is that another one of Hanke? Is that another one of Hanke's movies? Or
yeah.
His name?
Yeah, and it's disturbing. It's interesting though because it makes you look at even not so much the remake, but the original one. You kind of see the seeds planted because I noticed the parents' names are the same as the parents in Funny Games, George and Anna, and it's the same actor who played the father in the original Funny Games and this, the late Ulrich Muhy from The Lives of Others,
mm-hmm.
and the kid who plays Benny in the film, Arno Furst, plays one of the tormentors in Funny Games. So it was interesting. You see sort of where these ideas take shape. And it was interesting that way, and definitely shocking. I actually think, you know, if you watch that, then watch the original Funny Games, you sort of understand where he's coming from. But I still don't understand why he would go ahead and, in the 10 years, remake the exact same film. you not add something, maybe a different perspective, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You would think in 10 years you might want to add something new. Revisit something. So that's what I think one of my problems with the remake.
Well, you didn't like Funny Games because you thought it was essentially torture porn for the art crowd.
Essentially, you could say that.
Which is even worse than torture porn. It's like dishonest torture porn.
It's dishonest, but I don't know if it's... speaking of torture porn, David Edelstein, the film critic who coined that term, I read his review of the remake in New York Magazine today. And he couldn't stand it, and he wasn't crazy about the original one. I would give the original. I would be much kinder to the original one. Actually, I would actually say I like the original one, but since he went ahead and remade it, I think it tarnishes that one.
Right.
And I don't know if that makes sense. And I'm going to have to obviously watch some more films by him and come back to this in a couple of years. But and there are films. See, here's the thing. I like a lot of the films by Michael Haneke. I like Caché a lot. I like Time of the Wolf. I like The Piano Teacher. So it's just odd that you would go back and, it's like what you said about Paul Schrader, Taxi Driver and then Bringing Out the Dead. There's maturity. There's some, it's 30 years.
There is. And he, this is interesting. He's exploring the same theme, though. It's the theme of the guy, the insomniac. The city is driving him crazy. He sees the worst of the worst in the streets of New York City every single night. The dumpiest, the druggiest, the just the filth and the scum, and it's getting to him. But in the 70s, when they were young and they crafted Taxi Driver, they gave that character the only means of release that character had was through violence and
right.
Act of violence. And Bringing Out the Dead, it's very telling their maturity on this and how they've grown the past 30 years. All this lead character wants is peace.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wants to sleep, essentially. And I thought they had to have crafted it with Taxi Driver in mind. I'm thinking because the parallels are just so evident.
Yeah, it's that's based on an interesting book, Bringing Out the Dead, an interesting novel. And yeah, I thought that's a very underappreciated film. But
yeah.
But you bring up, where there's maturity there, where there's obviously something Paul Schrader in that time between both Scorsese and Paul Schrader have learned and they've matured. I don't, in the 10 years since Funny Games, I would like to think that maybe he would have added something new. Maybe I'm asking too much. I read the interview in LA Weekly last night with Michael Haneke, and I didn't get the feeling that there was anything different.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just me. I think Funny Games, the remake, is going to have a long afterlife on DVD.
Yes.
I'm looking at the
confirmation I sent yesterday from Michael Ian Black to let everyone know that out there that I do my job. I swear to God, I do my job.
He doesn't
we
love
had
the
a guest,
job.
We had a guest not show up Sunday night, and they apologized profusely, and they're coming on later tonight. But sent yesterday to the publicist, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. The show number's right there. Everything's there, and I even got the number that he'd be calling us from. So I'm sorry, guys, if he doesn't show up. You know what might be fun? We should get Blogstein or we should get Eric to call in, and we'll conduct the interview with him.
I'm all for that. I'm all for that. And if Mike and Alex want to call in, be my guest.
Yeah, exactly. But we love Michael Ian Black on the show, and he's hysterical. And believe me, since he confirmed for the show, I've been devouring every video and audio clip I can find of the guy, and he's hysterical. And actually, I first got to know him from the I Love the 80s stuff. And I know Mike and Alex are there saying maybe he's doing I Love the 20s for VH1. And that was going to be one of the questions I asked. I said, if you could choose a period of time to commentate on, what would you choose? Secretly hoping that he'd say something like the Holocaust. So wouldn't that be fine? VH1's I Love the Holocaust.
There you go.
Yeah, but anyway, I got to know him from I Love the 70s and 80s and 90s, and just a hysterical guy. And we're looking forward to having him on the show tonight. But it looks like, we're getting to the point of no return because our next guests are coming on in about 14 minutes.
Right.
I profusely apologize to anyone that tuned in tonight for him, but I hope you guys stick around. Give us a call. Let's talk movies. very relaxed environment until our next guests come on. Meanwhile, we will work to reschedule Mr. Black, hopefully as soon as possible, hopefully for this this Sunday, maybe.
Right, that would be
great. And I think we have a good old friend on the line here. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Jimmy.
What's up, man?
What's up, buddy?
How you doing, Eric?
I'm pretty good, Jerry. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. Trying not to make an ass out of myself on the air, but, you know.
Hey, we all got to strive for something, man.
That's what I told him before every show starts. Jerry, don't make an ass of yourself.
And
it's important to have...
And it never works, you know.
But it's important to have goals.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
You got any sharp objects in the room, Jerry? Get rid of them.
Oh, shit. All right. Guys, give me a couple minutes.
Oh, dear.
Eric, I want to start by discussing stand-up, your stand-up routine. Really, man, I have the interview like all laid out. I'm so excited. We're going to talk to one of the great comic minds, and nothing.
Well,
am
you're
I
talking to the wrong guy.
You want
one of the great comic finds, you got the wrong guy, man.
Yeah, I'm sorry, bud. You'll do for now.
Okay.
Hello?
Hey.
Hello?
Hey. Are we still on?
I can hear you.
Okay. I heard it. You just sound like someone, like a phone key or something.
That's what it sounded like to me. But
you know what it was? It was exactly what happened at the beginning of the show. It's like a Blog Talk Radio power outage or something.
I can still hear you guys.
What's going on? I'm wondering if this is possibly what happened to him tonight. If he called at a point where we got disconnected early on. That's a possibility.
Well, did you talk to the guys from Lost? I mean, obviously you've been in you've recontacted with them.
They're going to come on at the top of the hour, God willing.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is did they call Sunday and this happened to them on Sunday, or did they
call? No, they forgot it. They had the wrong time or something, possibly. I don't know what got mixed up. Actually, if you listen to the end of last week's show, it ends with me picking up a call from one of them, and I have to tell them they're an hour late. It was the star of the movie that called last week an hour late, and I said, I'm sorry, we're off the air now, but I really thought you were scary as hell in that movie. So call back next show. You know.
Yeah, he was kind of creepy.
It's
really creepy, that movie.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on your tolerance for that kind of movie, man. But, I mean, I know you and I had thoughts about it. We won't, you know, we'll talk about it later. But he was definitely an original performance, and he just went all out of the end.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the ending was very disturbing.
Yeah, that's a fearless performance right there. But halfway through the hour, we have Harry Basil and the screenwriting Cleveland brothers. They're going to talk about a new movie called Fingerprints. And Harry, we've had on the show before. He's very funny. He started out in stand-up. Actually, Dangerfield gave him his big break. And
really?
He used to headline with Rodney Dangerfield. And around the time that Jim Carrey was first starting. And he actually did Peggy Sue Got Married. He was standing alongside Jim Carrey and Nicolas Cage. It's part of that whatever doo-wop band they had in that movie.
Well, that's good company to keep.
Peggy Sue, anyone?
No, I haven't seen that in a long time. I liked it, but I haven't. It's been years since I've seen that.
Yeah, it's been forever.
Yeah, it has been a long time. Well, let me give Michael Ian Black to show how generous I am and how much I think of him. Let me go ahead and give him some plugs. Ready for some Michael Ian Black plugs?
Fire away.
There's a comedy CD out. It's his first one. It's called I Am a Wonderful Man. It's currently available in stores, and it's hysterical stuff. And he was coming on to discuss his new movie. It's called Run, Fat Boy, Run. And no, I'm not in it. And
Neither am I. I mean, you know, you don't have the monopoly on that, so.
He co-wrote the movie with Simon Pegg, who's huge right now. Don't ask me who he is. And it was directed by David Schwimmer. And it opens March 28th in theaters this month nationwide. March 28th this month, yeah, exactly. And the only gig I have for him, because he obviously he's a brilliant stand-up, the only gig I have for him here is April 3rd at the Madison Theater in Covington, Kentucky. So, I mean, he really should have called in because we are huge in Kentucky. I mean, our
I had no idea. I didn't know that about Kentucky.
That's why you're on the show. I mean, Jerry, you appeal to those Kentucky
folk.
No,
that's good. I love our fans in Kentucky.
Every time you talk about the funny games and then and Deliverance and
I don't
stuff.
Think they really care about that. I think they just want to hear me make an ass out of myself. But
that's what we all tune in, Jerry.
I know. No, I'm like the Phil Owen of this show. And you're probably going to ask who's Phil Owen.
Yeah. I would ask who's Phil Owen, but I really don't want to hear the story.
Okay, you don't want to hear the story. Okay.
It looks like everyone on the chat room can hear us. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, I apologize tonight. Tonight's pretty rough so far. but yeah, the movie is called Run, Fat Boy, Run, Mike and Alex, and it's going to be a funny one. Actually, look up that trailer, because the trailer
is
hysterical.
It's a great trailer.
You know, another trailer that came out this week is for that new Ben Stiller movie.
The Tropic Thunder, right?
Yes. It comes out August 15th. It's like Ben Stiller, Jack Black, Robert Downey Jr. as a method actor who plays a black character, so he goes through a chemical skin process. And it's like, Eric, you know, like Apocalypse Now and the documentary they made about the struggles behind Apocalypse Now, how they're in the middle of a war
right. Themselves
and all that kind of stuff. It seems to be parodying that. Like they're movie actors doing this war movie and they decide to put themselves in the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they're really just these characters, these actors that are romanced and wooed at every turn, and it's very funny stuff. Can I get some?
No, I mean it is. I'm very curious to see how this is going to play out. I know there's this manufactured controversy, but I actually got to say it looks very clever.
Yeah,
very
I think so
clever.
Let me see. Let me peek. This may or may not be our next guest. I'm going to see really quick. I'm showing a 214 area code, and I didn't get a phone thing for them. Let me see really quick. I have a 214 area code. Who's this on the line?
This is Jason Cleveland.
Jason Cleveland, and your
yes.
brother Brian is on the other line, I'm sure. I see him right there.
Yeah.
We're waiting Harry Basil, and then we will bring you guys on after a smashing introduction.
Sounds great.
Right,
okay,
cool.
So just give me one minute or so. Thank you.
Thank you.
I saw that it was similar to Mr. Black's area code. I think Mr. Black is a lost cause tonight, and we apologize for that. But we'll get him on maybe Sunday. Eric, in the meantime, have you seen anything good lately?
No, I haven't seen anything good lately, man. You know me and my work schedule. So
I come over to your house every 2 weeks and bring over the most depressing movie imaginable. The 2 weeks ago, I brought over the Jonestown documentary.
Yeah, which made me want to break my wrist.
You're worse than I am, Jamie.
That was a great Saturday night.
Yeah, that was wonderful. My wife loved it.
Yeah. And so I'm thinking, what's the most depressing movie I can bring over next Saturday? There's got to be like a 6-part documentary on something terrible in American history that I can.
Well, I'm sure you can find something like the nuclear bomb on Nagasaki or something.
Oh my
bring
God!
That over
I'm bringing over Blood of the Beast. That will. You'll never want to do anything ever again.
Well, that's good. That sounds like a good Saturday night then. I'll see you then, buddy.
That'd be great, man.
But I appreciate you calling in, man, and filling up some time for us.
No problem, buddy.
And hopefully you'll enjoy the rest of the show, where we actually have guests that call in and we can converse with them.
Sounds like a plan to me.
All right, buddy. Thank you, man.
All right, man.
Bye-bye. We're going to give Mr. Basil a couple more minutes to call in. In the meantime, this weekend's releases, Jerry. What are we looking at this weekend?
We're looking at, Drillbit Taylor with Owen Wilson and a Shudder, which is, I think, a remake of a Thai horror film.
A Die Hard film?
Oh, excuse me?
A Die Hard film?
Thailand. It's a remake.
Oh, a Thai horror.
Yeah, oh my God. Oh, great.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Our fans in Kentucky have hung up.
Yeah, we're big in Kentucky, man.
Mike and Alex Shudder does look terrible.
It really is the calm before the storm, isn't it? Because once Iron Man and Indiana Jones hits, that's it.
May is going to be, I thought last May was crazy. This May is even crazier. Iron
it's
going to
be big.
Speed Racer, Prince Caspian, Indiana Jones, Sex in the City. That's a lot of big films.
Yeah. And it's good the girls have something to watch when we're all watching Indiana Jones, reliving our childhood. You know?
That's true. That's what it is.
Yeah. All right, let's get started. We actually have a guest on the line, Jerry, so we're all set to go.
Let's go.
Okay, fans of the show are certain to recall just last month when we welcomed multi-talented comedian and filmmaker Harry Basil to our show to discuss his vampire film Souls Midnight, starring Armand Assante. Well, he's back tonight to tell us all about another terrific new film he's directed titled Fingerprints. Fingerprints tells the story of a troubled teenager who uncovers hidden secrets in a small Texas town. This enthralling film features a great cast, including Kristen Cavallari, Lou Diamond Phillips, and Sally Kirkland. Before moving into the motion picture front, Mr. Basil was discovered by Rodney Dangerfield and moved into the big leagues of stand-up comedy, honing a uniquely hysterical act built around his love and passion for the movies, and we can't wait to discuss that with him tonight in more detail. Tonight, Mr. Basil is joined by Jason and Brian Cleveland, the screenwriting brothers behind both Souls Midnight and Fingerprints. These are two wonderfully talented guys, and it is a great pleasure to welcome all of them to our program. Let me bring them up one by one. Harry, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm just paying the hooker. She's leaving the room.
Harry is with us.
All I have is a 20. I'm sorry. That's it.
I'm sorry. Hey, guys, how you doing? I'm in Vegas. I'm in Vegas right now.
Oh, Jason and Brian, you guys with us?
We're here. This is Brian. I'm Brian right here. And I just wanted to interject something really quickly. You guys were talking about depressing movies and Jonestown. Our dad, our father, Brian and Jason's father, he has a friend who, believe it or not, his friend's college roommate was Jim Jones.
Wow.
You're kidding me.
Can you imagine, like, freshman year, you know, you show up and there's, like, this guy in a Panama hat and sunglasses, and he's got this big jug of Kool-Aid, you know, and you're like, hey, man, what's that for? And he's like, I'll let you know down the road, you know. I'm going to spend a semester away in Guyana.
Oh, that's so terrifying, man. That's really terrifying. You know what strikes me, though, now that you mentioned Jonestown, I always wondered what it would be like to be the offspring of someone infamous, you know, and that was what was most fascinating to me about this documentary, because they interview Jim Jones's son, who has not changed his name. His name is Jim Jones Jr. And to know someone as your father and love them as your father, but at the same turn know what they were responsible for. I found that fascinating. Anyway, we're not here to talk about Jonestown, but I'm really looking forward to talking to you guys, because we had an opportunity to speak to Mr. Basil last month, and he was raving about the screenwriter brothers Cleveland, and so I had to have you guys on the show.
Thank you.
And I just I've obviously seen Souls Midnight. I just got around to seeing Fingerprints, and it's a dynamite film. And I'm fascinated in this collaboration, because any of us that have siblings, we know how different siblings can turn out to be. I mean, I love my brother to death, but he's a polar opposite for me. So how did this collaboration come about? I mean, is it a harmonious one?
It's more or less harmonious. And now it started, I lived in New York City for many years, and I worked in some documentary television. And so we actually started writing screenplays long distance and just kind of working through email and sending drafts back and forth. So we didn't, and then I ended up moving back to Texas after several years in New York City, and so that's kind of how we started. And so even today, we've written, I think, like 8 feature screenplays, but, you know, we really don't personally sit down together that frequently. So I think that cuts down on things like choking each other and throwing things and stuff like that. But I'll tell you what, the best reason to work with a brother, and I think Jason would agree, is that no matter how much we argue or get in a fight or disagree or whatever, we're always going to come back to it the next day. And I think the same cannot be said when you collaborate with someone who you're just friends with or just a business partner with. You know, it's very easy to become acrimonious and just throw in the towel, and we're probably not going to do that, especially now that we've had 2 movies made. So,
yeah, and fantastic movies too, and Mr. Basil certainly credits for that too, making 2 fantastic films. How are you doing, Harry? You got the hookers paid off?
Just to add what Brian said, they didn't mention that they have a younger brother, and sometimes we'll have him come around, and I've seen them really get abusive to him. So they both love to pick on the little one. No, I'm kidding. Actually, their younger brother is an actor, and we used him in Soul's Midnight, and it was his first acting role, and he did a really terrific job. You know.
So when you read these scripts, Harry. I mean, what comes to mind as a director? What stands out about these screenplays that they've provided for you?
Well, what I love is how they always include some real element, whether it's a part of history or some urban legend that everyone has heard about. As a matter of fact, Fingerprints, we haven't really talked about what the storyline is, but if any of your listeners out there is familiar with the haunted train tracks of San Antonio, there's this urban legend about a school bus that was hit by a train back in the 40s and all the children died on the train. And if you go there and you put your, you drive your car to the spot where it happened and you put your car in neutral and shut the engine off, it gets moved across the railroad track. And what people do is they sprinkle baby powder on the bumper and the hood, the trunk of the car, and you see these tiny little fingerprints that are supposedly from the ghost children. And people have been doing this for like 40 years. They've been going there and doing this gag with their car, and Brian and Jason are from Dallas, from Texas, and they had heard about this, and they've actually tried this, and that's what inspired them to write the story, and I love that,
Yeah, the actual train tracks, they're about 10 minutes south of downtown San Antonio, and it's really fun to go and do. I recommend anyone to do it. It worked for all of us. And
yeah.
I was surprised by two things. One, when we showed up there was a line about a quarter mile long of cars actually waiting to do this. And I was also surprised because it actually worked. And we did pour the baby powder on our bumper, but our bumper was a little bit dirty, so we couldn't quite tell what
there. This is in a small town in Texas where we're about again?
The actual train tracks are just south of San Antonio, downtown.
Okay.
San Antonio.
We have an Indian burial ground here near where I grew up in Florida that states the same thing, and it works too, oddly enough, where it kind of pushes your car back somehow if it's in neutral.
Yeah, and so this will, your car, if you put your car in neutral, it'll be pushed to the other side of the train tracks, and I don't know what exactly it is. It's a phenomenon, but it works, so I recommend anyone to go down and try it.
So the cool thing
about this, though, is it has this whole horrific story about all these children dying and this ghost story. And what Brian and Jason cleverly did was they wrote this whole story about this town who's been living with this dark secret for years, and there's this young girl who just got out of rehab, and her family's from California, and they moved to this town. And she had a near-death experience. Her boyfriend OD'd, and she came close to death. And since this near-death experience, she has been seeing this entity of this little girl, and the ghost girl is trying to tell her something. And what we hint at in the story is that maybe this didn't happen. Maybe this accident, the town maybe fabricated the story to cover up these children dying another way. And I was like, blown away by that hook. I was like, oh man, this is great. And they wrote such great characters, and there's these great teen characters in the story. Leah Pipes plays the main character, Melanie, and Leah's one of the stars of the CW's, what's the name of the show again, guys?
Life is Wild.
Yeah, she's just dynamite in the role. I guess, Jamie, you saw the film.
I did. I was blown away by it. I thought it was fantastic. And you guys have a great cast. I mean, all the way through. I mean, you guys have Lou Diamond Phillips and several.
We got.
Guys. Tell me.
I was just gonna say we got real lucky with our casting, and everything just kind of came together at the right time. And Josh Henderson, who's the shirtless hunk on Desperate Housewives, and of course everyone knows Kristen Cavallari, and you love her or you hate her from Laguna Beach, and then Jeffrey Lewis, who's become a cult horror guy. And now I think Sally Kirkland is going to become a cult horror figure from this movie, too.
Yeah, she's great in the movie. She's really great in the movie.
So Jason, were you as brothers always attracted to this genre? Are you guys?
Oh yeah, I remember being, you know, 7, 8 years old and being woken up in the middle of the night and Brian putting on Halloween to torture me so I could never, you know, get back to sleep. But so we've been watching these movies for quite a few years, and our parents are a little bit liberal, I guess you can say.
Yeah, we grew up with Alien, Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
wow.
And I would say Halloween is probably our defining moment, you know, from age 4 or 5 onward. You know,
it is for so many of us, man. I mean, I grew up with those same films. As soon as mom and dad went to bed, those are the films I plopped in. Terrified me, just absolutely terrified.
And you know what, they hold up. And the thing, I remember I was in fourth grade when The Thing came out, and a friend of mine and his mother, we went to see The Thing, and I loved it. I thought it was so cool, but it's like this friend's mother was like traumatized for life. I don't think she's ever gotten over it. And how satisfying is that experience?
That's one of those great experiences.
That is
well, also, the guys, you forget, they also love the Shining as well. And when we did Souls Midnight, we shot in an unbelievable location in Guthrie, Oklahoma, this
yeah.
Masonic temple that had these hallways that looked a lot like the hallways in The Shining. So I did a lot of these slow tracking shots. And in some of the reviews we've been getting, people have mentioned The Shining, which is pretty cool. You know, but they've also turned me on to some Italian horror movies. These guys... like they live and breathe horror, you know, day and
like
night.
Like Dario Argento, the kind of
yeah,
of
we love the old school Dario.
And you know, Mario
yeah.
Bava. It's funny because I you know, Black Sunday, which is such a gothic classic, and I'm gonna admit something that I'm ashamed to admit, but I had never seen Black Sunday until after we did Souls Midnight. And it's funny, I was watching it, and it does have some funny similarities, like there's the St. George's Day, and then there's the Resurrection, and there's a few almost uncanny similarities. And as I said, it was a pleasant surprise to see that, and that really turned me on to, you know, the black and white Bava movies. And then of course Lucio Fulci has some of the greatest death scenes, and the
yes,
Beyond
he does. Yes.
House by the Cemetery and Zombie, and we got the chance to see Zombie in the theater at the New York Horror Fest. And actually Fingerprints won the best feature at the New York City Horror Fest, and it was so cool to like watch classic Fulci in the same theater that they showed Fingerprints, and people really, you know, we had like a standing room audience and Fingerprints, and people really got into it, and we were so excited when they gave us best
feature.
Oh, that's
got to be gratifying.
Congratulations.
Harry, you told us about the production on Souls Midnight. How did this one go in comparison?
Well, we had a few more days on this, but we shot in Oklahoma City again and used a lot of the same crew, different DP. We brought in people from L.A. We had a better cast on this because, I mean, Souls Midnight was a great movie and a great script. This was a lot stronger script. It's more contemporary, has a young cast in it. And we got all these great actors for scale because they all loved the script. As a matter of fact, I got to throw this out there, too. We actually had Brittany Snow cast as our lead, and she dropped out to do Hairspray. But, I mean, she's the star of John Tucker Must Die and the new Prom Night. And,
right.
American Dreams, the TV series, and she loved the script and wanted to do the film. All these actors, they came in for like nothing, with the exception of Lou.
It's fantastic. It really is.
Because they loved the script, and the crew wanted to work on the movie too. But we were fortunate to have 16 whole days to shoot this movie, whereas the last one was 13. Had a little bit more money in our budget. They rode in a train crash. We had a train in the movie that we were able to use. And again, Guthrie, Oklahoma is this great little town. I mean, it's funny, right after that movie, Brian and Jason wrote another script for the town of Guthrie, Oklahoma, because it's like a movie set.
Mm.
You know?
It really is, and there's so many great locations, and we use the Masonic Temple and the train station. And another element, and I mean, if you're into horror and you're into paranormal stuff, the greatest thing about Guthrie is that several locations are actually haunted.
And in fact, one of our key locations in Fingerprints, which is a bed and breakfast called the Stone Lion Inn. In the film, it's Mary Pearl's house, but it's this big white gothic place. And actually, the Ghost Hunters from the Sci-Fi Channel.
Right.
Did one of their episodes there, and they got some creepy EVPs and stuff like that. And
It used to be a former mortuary, and they actually use the embalming table as the bar now. So
quite cool.
An interesting place.
So that was fun. Also, the train depot itself has a lot of ghost stories attached to it, and you're supposed to see a woman up in the upper story window at midnight when the train goes by, and there's just so many things like that really, I think, in subtle ways make a movie stronger, a ghost movie stronger, when you're really getting that sense of how creepy and real everything is. And
absolutely, that's dynamic stuff. And let me say that I've said it before, but doing the show, and I get sent volumes and volumes of films that are very subpar, and usually they're from the horror thriller genre. And so that I'm very relieved when A Soul's Midnight or especially Fingerprints comes my way, because it's just like a breath of fresh air. Finally something that does it right, an independent film that knows how to do it. So I commend you guys totally for these two films. But Brian, for these fledgling screenwriters out there, tell us a little bit about the path you guys took and how you finally got your foot in the door.
That's a good question, and I got to think back several years. I think that it was sort of a long and gradual process. Jason and I, as we said, we've always been interested in movies, and I actually turned down going to film school and did other stuff in college, and then kind of came back to it. I worked in documentary television, and Jason worked in some radio broadcasting. But we started to take some screenwriting classes and get serious about it, and that was maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And what I would say to screenwriters, and I know Jason agrees, is that you got to be willing to fail, and you got to be willing to write 2, 3, 4 screenplays that aren't going to sell, that aren't going to get you an agent, that aren't going to get you attention. And you just got to love doing it, and you just got to move on. And I think finally, if you really keep at it, you'll have a shot. But we got just so extraordinarily lucky, and what screenwriter or director or producer didn't get lucky at some point that we got to submit our idea for Soul's Midnight to Gray Fredrickson, who you had on not too long ago. And of course, he's a legendary producer. And he actually liked the idea that we had, and things came together with Soul's Midnight. We got to meet Harry Basil, and just got along with him, so well, and became friends with him. And so, we've just been so fortunate not only to have movies made, in the first place, but to have them made with a group of people that we admire and that we respect and that we're friends with. So I think, luck and just perseverance is what got us.
And I think, I was going to say, if somebody also wants to know more about our process and how we got involved producing the movies as well with Gray Mark Productions, the Hollywood Reporter just did a interview with us, and we go into great detail about how we actually got the movies financed and made. So,
oh, fantastic! Is that article available online?
It's available online. Yeah, you can go to the Hollywood Reporter, and I think if you just type in Cleveland in the search box, the first hit you'll get is about Jason and I and the whole way we got this thing going. And also
type in Fingerprints too, because I typed in Cleveland and I got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Type in Fingerprints, and we also talk about Image and them releasing the DVD. The DVD comes out this Tuesday, March 25th,
yes.
And I think Harry did a commentary track for the DVD. There are some extras on it, so it should be a really cool.
Yeah, there's
DVD.
A fun making of on it, and a bunch of other stuff.
I'm looking forward. I haven't seen any of these special features, and I want to hear Harry's commentary. So I think it should be. I think it should be exciting for horror fans, supernatural, paranormal fans, and also just people who want to see how a film gets made, especially on a very modest budget. And I think, Harry did an incredible job directing a movie of this caliber in so short a time with limited resources, and that I mean, that right there is a reason to check this movie out, I think. I mean, it's just...
Absolutely.
Right?
I can't tell you how great it is having, you know, Brian and Jason on the set as writer-producers. I mean, this is the second feature that they had made as writers, but also they produced the film, too.
Sure.
And whenever we have something thrown up against us, it's just great to have them to collaborate and write something new right there on the set, you know, and they've written a couple other scripts that I'd love to be able to direct every one of their scripts. They've written a couple of other horror films that I'm really excited about. We're all three of us are repped by the same manager, and we're sending all of our stuff out there trying to get a couple of new projects made, but they have
this could be one of those great all-time great fruitful collaborations.
We talk every day. I mean, we just talk about movies, and we genuinely love movies. And when we hear that there's a horror movie coming out, we want it to be successful. I mean, you know, we're hoping it'll be successful because then we want, you know, other production companies to keep making horror films, you know.
Absolutely. So Harry, was film director always something that you knew that you wanted to do even back when
I was a little kid. I mean, one of the first movies I ever made on Super 8 film was a Jaws spoof, and I won second place in the New Jersey Institute of Technology, and Otto Preminger was the judge and presented me with an award. It was pretty cool. And I said to him, I said, "Thanks a lot, Ot." And he just kind of looked at me. You know, "Who is this guy? Get him out of here. Give him the award. I want to go back to Hollywood. And screw Dorothy Dandridge."
I didn't get a chance to ask you last time. You were on with Mr. Fredrickson, and we were so focused on trying to get Mr. Fredrickson to curse, which he never did. But I did get to ask you about all these great talents that you worked with starting out in stand-up comedy. Obviously, we discussed starting out with Rodney Dangerfield, but you were up there with Jim Carrey and a variety of people.
Sam Kinison, right?
Yeah, Kinison, Dice. Roseanne, I'm in Vegas right now, and I'm performing at some little comedy club. I'm at the Comedy Stop at the Tropicana, if any of your listeners are coming to Vegas this week. I've been plugging Fingerprints like crazy. It comes out on DVD Tuesday, and I've been showing a trailer to the movie to my audience, and they've been digging it, and I've just been reminding everybody that the 25th, you know, the Fingerprints comes out. But I'm looking at, I walk down the strip, and everybody that I work with years ago at the Comedy Store, like, they all had Louis Andersons over at the Excalibur, Carrot Tops at the Luxor, Roseanne Barr's down the street, Ray Romano's at the Mirage. I'm like, Jesus Christ, these old guys. Yeah, I mean, I'm really happy to be doing what I'm doing and all, but a lot of my comic friends have all become superstars. But they've all been divorced two times, and I'm going on my 20th year, and there's one key success to that, finding someone you love. And hookers, it's just amazing. You just don't. That's the second time I mentioned hookers in this conversation.
And God bless Vegas for that. So is Vegas the best venue for stand-up in the country?
Well, there's just so many outlets. I mean, today, you know, there's comedy clubs everywhere. There's colleges. There's cruise ships. But yeah, Vegas is great, man. You know, casinos are fun to perform in.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when we were writing, I think when we were in prep on both of our films, Brian and Chase would come here. I'd always do like a week before we go into prep, and we'd like just go through the script and make the script tight. The great thing about Brian and Jason, both movies, not one scene is left on the cutting room floor. You know,
really?
I was pretty impressed with that and proud of that. They write very tight scripts. They're like 90 pages, 95 pages when we go in. Because I've worked on other films where you shoot stuff and it's like 120 pages or whatever, and you've got like five freaking scenes that are cut out, and you wish you had that time when you're making the movie to be able to, you know, you say, "Oh God, we cut the scene out. If I could have had that whole day, I could have worked on something else and gotten more coverage on what was kept in the film." Brian and Jason are very, very good at I mean, I think Fingerprints, the script that they turned into me, we pretty much shot that script. It was great.
Yeah, we were actually kind of, you know, they shot it word for word and didn't change anything. And Brian and I really attribute that to our meticulous outlines. We really try to write really organized, concise outlines before we actually start writing the screenplay. And
is that the most difficult part of the process, the most tedious?
Yeah, it can be, but I think it's also the most rewarding and the most fun. And I think it's an opportunity where you really, when you're in early stages, when you get to paint those really broad strokes, that's kind of where you let your imagination play around the most. And I always, to me, I always think that's fun. And then as you tighten your outline, it becomes more procedural. And then as you start to write scenes, you know, it's like any job where you just got to go in and plug it in day after day until you've got something that looks like a screenplay. And then, of course, writing is rewriting, as we all know. And that to me is the worst part, when you got to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite a script over and over. But fortunately, yeah, with Fingerprints, I think it was a story we knew we wanted to tell. And I think that the main character, Melanie Wood, just kind of came together in a very sort of organic fashion. I think she's a character that a lot of people can relate to. She's very human. She's empathetic, and so it just came kind of naturally and flowed kind of freely. So I think we wrote it pretty quick, and nobody ever really changed it that much, and we didn't rewrite it very much, and they shot it word for word, and I think it turned out pretty well. So
you know what I love about the script, Jamie, is that any of your female listeners out there, you know, whether or not you like horror movies or not, you're really going to love this movie, because the strongest characters in the film, I don't want to give away, but are all female characters, and they're really smart. And guys love it because it's a lot of both of these actresses are really good actresses, but they're beautiful too, and there's some good looking guys in the movie too. Besides Josh Henderson, Andrew Lawrence, Joey Lawrence's little brother is in the movie, and he's terrific.
He's hysterically funny. He's very witty.
Hysterically funny, sexy. It's a very sexy cast. And when another cool thing about this movie, it's a supernatural movie. It's you know, a ghost story, but it's also a slasher film too, which a lot of people who have been seeing that have been commenting on, that they've never seen those two elements put together, and that's what was a lot of fun about making this. But getting back to the script, when you cast a movie and you have actors come in, you're hearing the dialogue for the first time. And I've done a lot of movies with Rodney and some other comedies, and a lot of times you go, oh, geez, this script is in a lot of trouble when you hear the this movie, when I heard all the actors, everybody was great on the audition because the script was so well written and the characters were so well written. And I literally had so many actors that I could choose from, you know, for every part, because they all gave great readings, because it was a testament to the script. And again, you always go through that. You go, oh, geez, we got to rewrite that scene, because when you hear actors saying, you go, this is just terrible. But it all worked. It all worked.
I'm glad you mentioned the strong female characters, because that is something that is a rarity, particularly in this genre of film. And so that really does make the film a standout on a whole new level. It's just a completely rewarding film all the way through. It comes out on DVD this Tuesday, you said. I
everywhere, Blockbuster, Netflix, Amazon.com, you know, it's
March 25th.
I want to ask you, Harry, before we go, because you directed a film just a couple of years ago recently with someone that fascinates me, and I want to get your impressions of him, Burt Reynolds.
It's funny, because Jason, that's where I met Jason. Jason worked on that film as a PA.
Can I, don't give away, Harry, the fact that Burt Reynolds is the killer in Fingerprints, okay? Don't give that away.
But anyway, Jamie, what's your question about Burt?
I just want to know what that collaboration was like, what you took from him most, you know, your impressions.
It was an honor to work with Burt. I've been a huge Burt Reynolds fan. I love, you know, White Lightning and Deliverance and The Longest Yard and all of his films. And I had worked with him in Meet Wally Sparks, a Rodney movie that I had written,
yes.
And I was a producer on it, and he had a small part in that. But the fun thing about this was it was a Burt Reynolds movie. And he was just great, man. He was a blast. He's a terrific actor. He's funny as hell. He cracks up the crew. One of my favorite things in the movie, the script was actually written by Al Ruddy, who produced The Godfather and Million Dollar Baby.
Cool.
And while we were shooting that, Al was also making Million Dollar Baby, but Cloud Nine, which is the movie with Bird, it's a beach volleyball comedy. That was like his pet project, and Al was out on the set every day, and he and Bert go way back. Bert was just really, really cool, man. I was actually scared to work with him because I heard stories about him punching directors.
Right.
And I remembered I had worked with a really big script supervisor on another film I did, and I tried to hire that guy because I figured the script supervisor would be sitting next to me the whole time, and if Bert wanted to punch me, I got this big guy in between us. But I didn't need that. Bert was terrific. He was a lot of fun. The only problem with Bert was he had a fake tan in that movie, and they had to spray it on him every day, like Earl Scribe. And he
right.
There was a scene where he was in a pink bathrobe, and it kept getting stained. And I'd walk in, and I'd see them spraying him. But one time I walked in, and they were going to put the toupee on him. And it was like, remember when that guy in, I think it's Empire Strikes Back, walks in on Darth Vader when they're lowering the helmet over his head? That's what it was kind of like. Dun, dun, dun. over his head. But other than that, Bert was great, man. Bert was great.
Oh, that's great to hear, man. So Fingerprints out on DVD this Tuesday. Look for it. It's in video stores all over the country. I highly recommend you pick it up. It's a great, rewarding film. What's next for you guys, Jason and Brian? You guys working on something?
I think we're close, and I'm knocking on wood as I say that. We wrote a script, and we're really happy with it, and it's been to a lot of people, and people are getting really excited about it. It's about these two young Wall Street guys who go to Russia to do this oil venture, and they get mixed up in this murder, and they actually get sentenced to life in a Siberian prison where these unspeakably bad things happen. I don't want to give too much away, but it's part horror movie, it's part action movie, it's part noir, and that's something that we're really think is might be close to production, and we'd love to. I think that would be could be a really big film and really stylish.
It's kind of like Midnight Express meets a horror element. It's really cool.
Oh wow, that sounds great.
And then
go ahead, buddy.
I just wanted to say real quick, we actually just finished a script a couple days ago, and we're really excited about that one too. We love the city of New Orleans, and for those of you out there, New Orleans is not a bummed out underwater crime-ridden place. It's actually, there's a lot of stuff going on there, and we spent last summer in this house, in this apartment overlooking this famous mansion that used to be owned by this woman named Madame LaLaurie, and she's famous for torturing her slaves back in the early 19th century, and we wrote a script about a hurricane that's bearing down in New Orleans and these strangers that get trapped inside the LaLaurie mansion, and it's kind of that goes back to Fingerprints, using a little bit of history and a little bit of truth, and so you can, if you're on Google right now, you can research LaLaurie and find
and
out all
she was a pretty terrifying woman, and we're pretty happy with it. It's a pretty scary script.
Oh man, you guys' upcoming work sounds just as fantastic as what you've already produced. And then thank you both so much for coming on.
Yeah,
and Harry,
you're
going to be at the Tropicana throughout the week in Vegas. And what's after that?
I'm going back to LA and just trying to get something, trying to get a movie going. Gaddafi meets George Foreman, I think, might be the thing. That's an inside joke. That's an inside joke for Ryan. Also, Glenn Jensen is really great in the movie. I had to mention Glenn.
Yeah,
we love
absolutely.
Glenn. He's great.
Absolutely. And Harry, you're welcome back on the show whenever you want. You got a place here anytime, man.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Brian, Jason. Thank you again. And
thank you.
Brian and Jason, don't forget to rent Fingerprints on Tuesday,
March 25th.
There you go.
Next Tuesday.
Thank you, guys. Jamie, thanks a lot, man. Take care.
Thank you.
One last thing.
Yeah.
You guys were talking about Indiana Jones and all these aging action heroes that came back. I understand that in the new Indiana Jones movie, he's not using a whip. He's going to use the loose skin under his neck to, like,
hit people. Oh,
I thought you were going to say he's going to use Calista Flockhart, but...
No.
That would be cool.
Anyway, I'm looking forward to that movie. That's the one movie I'm looking forward to the most. Take care, guys.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Good night now. Bye-bye. That's a great bunch of guys right there.
Oh, they sound like a lot of fun.
A great group of filmmakers. That is Harry Basil, director of Fingerprints, and the screenwriting brothers, Cleveland, the Cleveland brothers, the screenwriters behind Fingerprints. That film is released on DVD next Tuesday.
We're going to be hearing a lot about all of them for many decades to come, no doubt.
I'm sure we are. They're a great bunch of talented guys. And our next guests, I believe, are on the line.
Let's do it.
So let's get to it. And the new horror film, The Lost, out on DVD shelves yesterday, I believe it came out. Director Chris Severtson and actor Mark Center paint a frightening portrait of a sociopath nearing a complete and devastating breakdown. Mr. Severtson's previous credits include All Cheerleaders Die and I Know Who Killed Me, starring Lindsay Lohan. And Mr. Center has a series of television roles in his resume, including performances in top shows like JAG and NCIS, and he's featured in the upcoming films Wicked Lake and Cabin Fever 2. Mr. Center gives an original, terrifying, and fully realized performance in The Lost. And through the guidance of Mr. Severtson's direction, the picture excels in earning scares that stick to your gut long after the movie ends. It is a great pleasure to welcome writer, director, producer Chris Severtson and actor Mark Center to our program. Let me bring them up here. I believe this is Chris. Chris, are you with us? Chris, hello?
Hello.
Hi, Chris.
Oh, that's me. That's Mark.
Oh, that's Mark. Okay, let me see if I can find Chris here on
Chris,
the line.
Chris, where are you, buddy?
Chris, is that you?
Wow.
Is this Chris?
Can be.
Hello?
Okay, I don't think that's Chris. Chris, is this your line here?
Let me see. It's still Mark.
Well, I have three different lines here, and they all have the same area code, so I'm trying to differentiate them. I have one more try here. Let's see here. I have an 818. Is this Chris?
Yes. This is me.
Oh, finally success. How are you doing?
Okay, I'm good.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. I appreciate you both coming on so much.
Thanks for having us.
So Chris, I wanted to start out. This is a terrifying film, and it's the second film I've had people on discussing in the past few months based on a Jack Ketchum novel.
Right.
What do you think it is about Jack Ketchum that makes him so special for cinematic adaptation?
Well, his stories are pretty perfect for the movies, for one thing, just that they're very lean and concise.
Yeah.
And he just creates characters that feel very, very real and that you really care about, and then he puts them in absolutely horrendous situations.
Mm.
You know, I think just his characters are a huge part of it. You know, they're not just cookie cutter, people that are thrown in there to be killed, but they're actually real people. And you never know what's going to happen. And it's just, you know, a really exciting universe that he's created, I think.
So did Chris, did you or Mark, did either of you meet with Ketchum before you started on the film?
Yeah, I went to visit him in New York during the screenwriting process after I'd had a couple drafts and just hung out with him and talked about stuff and just, you know, I tried to keep him in the loop throughout pre-production. He read a few of the different drafts and had input and was really helpful, you know. It was a really cool process.
Because I'm just wondering, someone that writes such dark material, what they're like, what they're really like.
Yeah, that's the thing. I found, you know, through meeting lots of people who write dark stuff or make really dark stuff, that they usually tend to be really laid-back, fun people to hang out with. Because it seems like they get it all out, all their aggression out, you know, on the page or in a movie or whatever. But Dallas, you know, Mayer, a.k.a. Jack Ketchum, is just a really laid-back, nice guy who can, you know, who you can talk all night to about any kind of topic. He's just
right. Mark, you were about to say something?
Oh, no, I just said just like you, Chris. As far as them being that way, you know.
Yeah.
And being these different kind of sensitive guys.
So Chris, how did this project come about for you?
I read the book almost exactly 5 years ago. It was March 2003, I think. And just kind of got obsessed with it and just kept talking about it and talking about it. And my friend Lucky McKee, I just kept telling him about it. At the time we were actually living in the same apartment complex. And so just talking about what we're into, all night long. And I kept talking about this movie, and this book, and he basically said, well, why don't I try to get the rights to it, and we can see if we can make a movie out of it. Mm-hmm. And that happened pretty quickly, and, I spent, the next year adapting it, which was a long process because it's actually, I said Ketchum's work is really concise, but The Lost is his longest novel at 400 mm-hmm. pages. And I wanted to keep as much as I could, wanted to really keep all the stuff I loved about it. So then I just spent a year adapting it draft after draft into a good script, that I was happy with, while at the same time starting to hustle up the money and figure out how to actually get it done.
Yeah, sure. And it's a fascinating story and an even more fascinating character. Mark, can you tell our audience a little bit about the plot and the character that you play in the film?
The character I play is Ray Pye, he's just, I wouldn't even know where to begin. The guy's so multicolored and has so many dimensions to him, which is one of the things that ultimately really attracted me to him. I mean, the first time I read the script, I hadn't read the book yet, but I read the script and was just kind of floored by it. And, you just don't get that many scripts that hit your desk with characters like that. And, it was just mind blowing. And, geez, I don't know where to begin.
The character itself is just a completely unique kind of creation. I mean, he's familiar on one hand, and yet someone you've never quite seen before on the other. And I thought it was a fascinating performance you gave. So tell me about that journey, that process of crafting that character. What went into it, and what was important about it?
I guess, like I said, right when I picked it up, there was just so much on the page. And so much for me to work with. It was just kind of like tying everything together and just kind of figuring out how to map it all out. And, fortunately, Chris's adaptation was really, really strong. And, then I started reading the book and getting more deeper into the book and just kind of like trying to piece together, what Jack Ketchum originally wrote and what Chris adapted. So it just was a lot of time spent with the material and just trying to start piecing this whole thing together because he is such a multifaceted character. So, just honestly, man, it's just countless hours spent with the book and the script, and then just a lot of time at my studio with my acting coach, just trying to piece the whole thing together and exploring and, what worked and what didn't work and just kind of easing into it. And, the fun part about this guy was that it's there's so much to him that fortunately, there was a month or two prior to shooting that I had to kind of explore and just try stuff out, which helped me out a lot. So it just, I don't know, man. Well, I feel like
I want to get into some of the particulars of the performance, but Chris, if you could tell us a little bit about, give our audience a sense of what the story is about.
Yeah, the story is about this 19-year-old guy, Ray Pye, who kills a couple of campers just for fun. He's always wanted to see what it feels like to kill somebody, so he just does it on a whim one day and gets away with it. And the bulk of the movie takes place 4 years after that. And the cops have always known that he did it, but they could just never prove it. So they're trying to get a break in the case, pushing at him, trying to get him to crack. But meanwhile, it really just focuses on the relationship that he has with the people around him in this little town that he lives in, particularly the three women in his life.
He's essentially a time
sends everything into chaos eventually again.
Yeah, essentially he's a time bomb about to go off.
Yeah, that was one of the big challenges of the material was to because it opens up with this very violent act, but then it kind of slides into this real deliberately paced drama. And so one of the challenges was to keep that time bomb ticking and, you know, see if that could, you know, hold the audience, the audience's attention until, you know, it's inevitable explosion at the end.
Now, is this based on a true story?
It's very loosely taken from a couple true stories. But really, you know, like some of the specific details of the Ray Pie character are based on a guy named Charles Schmid from the 1960s who killed a couple girls and was known as the Pied Piper of Tucson.
Yeah.
And some other incidences, like the beginning murder from the book was based on a completely different story that happened in the 90s. But ultimately, you know, Ketchum just kind of took those things as a jumping off point and really created a whole new thing, I think.
Right. And one of the aspects of the performance I wanted to talk about was with you, Mark, was the makeup. Does that act as some sort of mask for the character in a way?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that I found so interesting about the guy. And as Chris was saying, you know, it's loosely based on this real-life guy, Charles Schmid, who, you know, did just that. You know, he wore the makeup and had this whole Elvis persona. But it's interesting because we've got this guy at the core who is, like, brutally insecure and just has, like, you know, just numerous fears and insecurities, and it's, like, how he masks that is through his wardrobe and through his makeup. So it's just, like, you know, it's just so funny because at the core you've got this one guy, but on the outside, you know, he's got the makeup and the boots and the whole Elvis persona, and it's, like, you know, whatever he can do to mask it and make himself feel or at least appear bigger than life or appear, you know, larger than life. So whatever you can do to mask those insecurities, which ultimately are the things that are boiling at the surface and ready to just explode. So,
And I know I don't know if you've seen the DVD yet, but your audition is actually on the DVD. And it was fascinating to watch. When you saw that audition, Chris, did you know right away that Mark was the one? And what was that quality that he gave that you were looking for?
Well, I was really nervous beforehand about being able to find someone that could really pull off, you know, the character. And Mark was, you know, literally the second guy that I saw audition. But the thing is, it totally took me off guard because I had had this guy in my head for so long. But I kept, you know, and I still auditioned tons and tons of people and then ended up doing callbacks and all that stuff. But the thing that Mark really tapped into on that first audition was the fact of how unpredictable Ray is. You know, he would just do weird things that I just didn't understand at first. And those kind of stuck in my head, and I kept thinking about him. And that really kind of, you know, crystallized this fact that, oh, that's who Ray is. You know, he's got this sort of energy that you can't quite pin down. You know, he's different people to... He's a different person to everybody he knows, you know, which I think everybody is to some extent, but he's like, you know, that times 100.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about the violence in the film, because it's portrayed very realistically. And I was wondering, were there films, first of all, that you looked to as inspiration for crafting the violence and the feel of this movie?
Yeah, definitely. There's several films that were a huge influence on it, particularly the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, just the whole ending of the movie is very inspired by, like, you know, the big dinner sequence, you know, towards the end of that movie. That's just this huge, like, interior sustained chaos that's, like, so
absolute
hysteria, crazy and terrifying, you know.
Yeah. I also got a feel of something like Last House on the Left, especially in that opening camping scene.
Yeah, that's always a movie that's, you know, stuck in my head and had a huge impact, especially, you know, when I first saw it. That and also stuff like Taxi Driver and Clockwork Orange and also, you know, teen drama kind of stuff like River's Edge.
Mm-hmm. I get that too. At the same time, I thought it was great how you portrayed the violence in the film because, how do I put this? You show what is absolutely necessary to relate the horrific nature of what this man is capable of, and yet you could not classify it as so many movies made nowadays, whatever they call torture porn. I mean, the worst violence that occurs in the film actually happens off screen, I think.
Yeah.
Was that a conscious effort? Were there things that you wanted to avoid doing when you crafted the violence in the piece?
Yeah, well, really, like, the main goal when thinking about crafting the violence in the movie was what is going to be, you know, the most effective and what's going to be the most, you know, going to just hit people on a gut level.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ray kind of has this big rampage that ends the movie. And at the beginning of that rampage, I intentionally tried to glamorize it in a sense, almost as how Ray would see himself as this, like, avenging angel. And when he first starts, you know, going on a spree at the end, there's, like, all this rockin' music and all this slick camera movement and everything.
Sure.
And then by the time we get to, you know, the real end of the movie in this house out in the middle of the woods, all the music and everything is stripped away, and it all just goes to this very kind of cinema verite feel, to where you just really see, you know, hopefully what, at least, or not even see, but just feel like what something like this actually happening would feel like, you know, just trying to get a little bit of that across. So it was always just like a matter of thinking, like, what would be the most effective. And like, for example, the off-screen thing that you're talking about, you know, there's a big, extremely, heinous act at the end of the movie. And I decided to have that off camera because I just thought it would be, you know, even more painful that way. And if I just cut to what he was doing to this woman, it would become about the special effect.
Right.
So, you know, it was always just trying to, you know, really be thinking, like, what would be the most hard-hitting way to show any particular thing.
Yeah, it is very skillfully done, and it does stick to your gut, like I said in the intro, absolutely. But, Mark, with this type of performance, particularly where you take it by movie's end, I mean, tell me about living in that kind of frenzied state. Is there kind of a need for some kind of levity on the set, or are you guys there in that frenzied state all along?
Well, I just kind of how I work. I like to, you know, stay in it as best as I can, so that, you know, it's as real as it can be, and it's as, you know, spontaneous and irreverent. And you know, it was definitely a trip, but it was like, I don't know, I just think, like, at one point I hit a groove and I just wanted to kind of stay in that groove. So it was like, you know, there was moments where it was like really intense, and I mean, I don't know, man, I just kind of feel like at one point I really locked in, and I just wanted to kind of hang in there and ride it through, you know, I don't know, it was intense, and I feel like that, you know, ultimately just gave so much more to everything.
Yeah.
And
you were in the zone, man.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there.
So Chris,
totally.
from a director's standpoint, when you're directing scenes like that, I mean, do you try to keep it, I don't necessarily mean light on the set, but do you stay in that kind of mood, or how do you operate that kind of set?
I just think that you have to feel it out on, like, a moment-by-moment basis. Basically, what I mean by that is feel what the particular actors in the scene need, you know, because some of the actors are very method and just very want to much stay in it, and others like to go in and out of it, and I like working with both kinds, and I think it's cool to play them off of each other. But, like, when the really, really heavy stuff of the movie, it was usually, like, you know, a complete morgue in between takes. Everyone just kind of, like, no talking. Everyone, there was such intense stuff that, you know, they had to pull off on camera that it's just, like, just as a mere thing of just reserving energy, you know. There was just a lot of, like, sitting, staring at the wall, you know, between takes for a lot of the actors.
I can imagine.
But then, you know, there's a bunch of other stuff in the movie that's a lot more lighthearted and fun, so, you know, that vibe would usually carry over in between those takes. So I think it was a nice balance between the really exhausting emotional stuff and the more lighthearted stuff.
Yeah, the movie's called The Lost. It came out on DVD yesterday, didn't it?
It's out there.
Starting yesterday, it's available. Now you did this one right before I Know Who Killed Me, didn't you? Did this one make I Know Who Killed Me possible for you, or?
Yeah, basically. This was like the movie that, you know, got the attention of the producers and got me the job.
Well, I want to tell you that we've received a lot of emails since we announced you guys coming on the show. And there's a lot of positive feeling out there, actually, for I Know Who Killed Me. I know you took some bumps for it.
It's been an interesting experience, for sure.
Did you take any positives from that experience? What did you take away from that?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's tons of positives. Before I made that movie, after having made The Lost, I was in serious debt, you know? And that took care of that problem.
Well, that's important, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's like, huge. And, but, you know, at the same time, I don't say that, you know, to denigrate the film. I was happy with the whole experience making it. It was difficult. It was a difficult shoot in a lot of ways, but, you know, they all are, to, you know, in one way or another.
Well, about 6-7 months ago, we spoke to one of the co-stars of the film, Spencer Garrett, and he let us know that he thinks the world of you. So I want to relay that message.
Oh, thank you. That's
from
cool.
6-7 months ago. Anyway, the film is called The Lost. It is an amazingly effective horror film, and I see so much of them every week. So, like I said before in the show, it's refreshing when I find one that actually works, and yours works like gangbusters, my friend. And it came out yesterday on DVD, and Chris and Mark, thank you both for coming on tonight. I'm glad this worked out for us, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thanks a lot. It was fun.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, guys. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you. Take it easy.
Bye. Bye-bye now. That is director Chris Severtson and actor Mark Center. Their film is called The Lost, based on the Jack Ketchum novel. And it is a down-and-dirty horror film, if you like them down-and-dirty like that. But not exploitative, which I think is important to note. Then this is the movie for you. Look for it on DVD. Jerry, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still with you. I've been manning the chat room.
Oh, how's the chat room been going?
Oh,
I'm
my
sorry.
God, dude, you have missed out. We had one very foul customer in the chat room.
Oh, do we?
Oh, well, he's gone now, but unfortunately, because you're the person in charge of the chat room, we really needed you to block him, because he was insulting Olivia. So I couldn't, I mean, if you did it, you could get a ban from the chat room. I have no control. It's not my chat room, you know. Cause,
oh, really? Are you serious about that?
Yes, I'm very serious about that.
So someone was giving our girl Olivia a hard time?
Yeah, but I would like to give some shout-outs to Jason, Alicia.
Olivia's my girl, man.
Yeah. The Olivia, Jason,
Olivia's
O'Brien,
taken,
Alicia.
Olivia's taken off.
The Rub, Mike and Alex, Eric G., Dr. Blogstein, everyone, the Rob, everyone's been in our chat room tonight, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I see that Jason O'Brien is here in the chat room, and he's got his own great show. It's called Oscar Oscar. It airs every Monday night at 11 p.m. Eastern. And I thank him for being with us tonight. And everyone out there. And Jerry, if you can give me a call after the show and tell me more about what transpired, I'll make
sure.
But thank you, everyone, for joining us in the chat room. A lot of support out there. We apologize for Michael Ian Black. We sent, a reminder message the other day, yesterday, and we were assured that everything was on the up and up. But thank you all for hanging in with us.
Yeah, we appreciate
and,
it.
Sunday, Mark Harris on the show, talk about the 67 Oscar race. And then Wednesday, two-hour tribute to Paul Schrader with Jeff Goldblum.
And
can't beat that. Dana Delaney, A Desperate Housewife, and The Fly on the same show. Come on.
That's awesome.
And
don't forget China Beach. Don't forget China Beach.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking, though, when China – and I'll make this very quick. When China Beach came on, I was like, man, she's attractive. She is still a babe. I don't want her to hear this and be afraid of coming on the show, but she is gorgeous.
Dude, she's awesome. She's Dana Delaney. Come on.
I mean, it's too bad this
she's
is radio
on our show.
Because she's just gorgeous. So that's an exciting show. We might actually have other guests on that night, too, maybe some late-stage confirmations. And then the following Sunday, we welcome Mr. Schrader himself to the show, as well as Ira Sachs, the director of Married Life, and possibly Michael Ian Black, if we can reschedule. Coming in April, Just got my press credentials for the Sarasota Film Festival. I am about to get my geek on in a major way.
Yeah, you
gonna
are.
I'm going to take in 3 or 4 movies a day. It's going to be something else. I'm excited about that. So you guys will get reviews for movies that won't be out in theaters for months and months and months. Stick with us. We'll take care of you. And the plus, we'll be giving you our one-year anniversary. I think we're going to do it Wednesday, April 16th, to celebrate our 1 year on air.
Can we like stretch it out a couple of shows?
We might. There's a possibility. I think I want to get it all over in one bang.
You
want to get it over with?
Okay.
Yeah. And we're going to give away tons of stuff. So please call in, take part. It's going to be an exciting show. And look for that Wednesday, April 16th, as it is right now. That's the day we're planning on. Thank you, everyone, for joining us in the chat room.
Thank you very much to everyone, please.
My cohort in movie geekdom, Jerry.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, it was my pleasure. It was a lot
couldn't
of fun.
Do much.
Except
couldn't
for
do
that
much.
One guy, which I'll tell you about later. But
yeah, you give me a call right now. We'll talk
I will.
About it.
All right,
guys. We love everyone out there. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you on Sunday night, guys.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everyone. Bye-bye.